Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State, Division of Historical Resources, and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, on the web at myfloridahistory.org. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on the program, the Tidally United Summit being held in Cape Canaveral will explore issues surrounding the impact of climate change on our cultural heritage resources.
Climate change doesn't respect jurisdictional boundaries. Climate change does not respect plaques on buildings. And it becomes ever harder to hold things as they were.
We'll discuss Virgil Hawkins and his role in Florida's civil rights movement.
In 1976, the Florida Supreme Court ordered that Hawkins be granted a license to practice law. In 1977, at age 69, he opened an office in Leesburg.
And we'll meet the Robinson family of Webster. All that ahead on Florida Frontiers. The Tidally United Summit is being presented by the Florida Public Archaeology Network and the City of Cape Canaveral, December 5th through 7th. The conference will address issues surrounding the impact of climate change on our cultural heritage resources. When keynote speaker Marcy Rockman was Climate Change Adaption Coordinator for Cultural Resources at the National Park Service, she was made aware of a vulnerability assessment of the launch complexes at Cape Canaveral.
It was August or September of 2018, I got an email from one of the Department of Defense archaeologists who is responsible for Cape Canaveral. And he said they had just finished a vulnerability assessment study looking at erosion along the Cape. And what it was telling them is that several of the early launch complexes, the Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo launch complexes, were likely to be in the water, as he said, in 15 to 20 years. And this was 2018, so that was 5 years ago. So we're now in the 10 to 15 year range. And what he said to me was really striking because he said, I know we need to keep up these places, they're historic resources, but if they're going to be in the water in 15 to 20 years, he said, there's no one with epaulets on their shoulder who's going to approve money to keep up places that are going to be at risk so quickly. So how do I let them go? And that was his foremost question to me was, how do I let them go?
The current guidelines for heritage preservation in the United States were part of legislation passed in 1966, before climate change was even considered when discussing cultural resources.
The way the National Historic Preservation was set up is it essentially put in place a process so that any project that was happening on federal land with federal money, or that in any other way needs to comply with federal regulations, they had to consider the effects of that project on cultural heritage. And it's not all cultural heritage, it's heritage that is considered significant or eligible to the National Register of Historic Places. That's another side conversation of how that decision gets made. But it, at the time, it really was a dramatic step in essentially slowing down the process. And I think a phrase I've heard used is the point of the National Historic Preservation Act wasn't to stop the bulldozers, but it was to at least slow them down. And sometimes now we talk here about regulation, oh, it's slowing progress and so forth. And again, I can't address all of those pieces, but for heritage and our cultural resources, that was the point, was to give space to identify what is important here and allow and really require consultation with the community to figure out how to work some preservation into those plans.
The 1906 Antiquities Act, the 1935 Historic Sites Act, and the 1966 National Historic Preservation Act were all responses to threats to our cultural heritage. Marcy Rockman says that now we need to address the impact of climate change.
The challenge that we have now with climate change is that these methods of preserving heritage that were set up 1906, 1935, and then in 1966 is that they drew boundaries around things, places. They put plaques on them. They said, we'll conserve these as is. But climate change doesn't respect jurisdictional boundaries. Climate change does not respect plaques on buildings. And it becomes ever harder to hold things as they were. One of the really most quoted items from the 1916 Organic Act that set up the National Park Service is that these places will be preserved, quote, unimpaired. We will preserve them unimpaired for the enjoyment of future generations. And everyone I know who works in ecology and also historic preservation says, holding something unimpaired as unchanging, that was actually never going to work well. It's now really hard to do. So we are now really facing this challenge that we have a system of historic preservation in which our primary methods of preserving no longer work in the way that they had when they were first designed. At the same time, I want to recognize, and I think it's helpful for all of us to recognize, that each of those pieces of legislation were an effort to address a major problem that each of those times saw. 1906, they saw looting of archaeological sites in the Southwest, and so they passed legislation to address it. 1935, it was actually President FDR and President Roosevelt said, the U.S. doesn't have a heritage agency, and it should. So they created some new powers for the National Park Service. And in 1966, it was the destruction from the urban renewal. So that's really a challenge for us now to say, okay, if we're seeing a new problem, which I think we are, what legislation might we need to help address those?
Once in a while, maps of Florida that have been generated as part of climate change studies make their way onto social media. They project that in a few decades, the bottom third of the state and much of its east coast will be underwater. Rockman doesn't believe that the general public is aware of the devastating effects that climate change is expected to have on our cultural and heritage resources.
Heritage and culture as part of climate change, it's often just, it's not there. It's just silenced. We don't see it very often. We don't have good mechanisms for talking about it. And I will recognize that in the work that I have done in climate change broadly, where I will see attention to heritage and culture is in relationship to Indigenous communities, which absolutely do. And I am so grateful. It feels like it's getting, I'm sure it still needs, it needs even more attention than it's getting, but it is there. What strikes me is often that is the only place that heritage will be talked about. And so there's almost a divide drawn between different kinds of communities and who is recognized as having history and heritage. And I will say connection and knowledge of place, because that is what heritage is, and who is not recognized as having that. And then it often doesn't translate into how are we caring for these places? How are we talking about them? What are our federal and state and local mechanisms to take care of them? The conversation often doesn't go that far. So no, I don't think that's one of our challenges, is that it's not part of our conversation often enough.
If the permanent loss of physical cultural heritage resources is inevitable, what should we be doing now to preserve and protect these resources to the extent that we can? Marcy Rockman.
Some colleagues over in Scotland run a program called the SCAPE Project, and they have worked for multiple years now with communities along the coast of Scotland that are losing some of their heritage due to increased erosion. And they've set up what I think is an absolutely a beautiful, but also very pragmatic approach. And they have said, we cannot hold back the sea. We cannot keep things as they are, but we can help you carry forward some of what is important about this place. What would you like that to be? Like, what a powerful set of questions. And then they use a whole range of different techniques, from archaeological excavation, oral history, filming, other forms of documentation, to help those communities address, map, document, investigate whatever portion that they have chosen, and help carry that forward.
Marcy Rockman provided advice on climate change issues to the State Department team that negotiated the 2015 Paris Agreement and helped to develop a major strategy document released in 2017, where her work was recognized as a voice on the world stage for climate change and heritage. Good progress was being made, but then that changed.
I left the National Park Service in 2018 because it felt impossible for me to stay. And one of the points that I can raise is my role there has not been refilled. While I was there, I was essentially a program of one. And to restate, I was responsible for figuring out what climate change would mean for all of the cultural resources across all of the Park Service, engaging with other federal agencies and also working on the international stage, which was a rather large position for one person. I would argue probably needed more than one, I can tell you that. But one of our challenges now is my role has not been refilled. And so the lead federal agency for cultural heritage in the US does not have cultural resources staff as part of its climate change program. And that's a question I think all of us should be asking, why not? What happened? And then what are we losing because of that? And how can that situation be turned around?
Marcy Rockman will be the keynote speaker at the Tidally United Summit, December 5th through 7th in Cape Canaveral.
That's going to be during the second week of COP28, which is the big UN Framework Convention on Climate Change meeting over in Dubai, which is going to be trying to figure out really big, the big climate change directions for the planet. At that sort of summit, there's a whole bunch of side events and surrounding festivals and so forth. And I know a number of heritage colleagues are going there, and they have been working very hard to get a presence there and try to make heritage visible in that space. And I will say it is incredibly important that they are doing that, and I am grateful to them. But with such a big event over there, it takes so much planning and coordination to get there that sort of focus is on being there and just having the voice. It's not on building new ideas and new plans of action. But that's what Tidally United will allow.
Marcy Rockman is Associate Research Professor at the University of Maryland, College Park. This is Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Visit us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org, where you can find archived episodes of this program, watch our public television series Florida Frontiers, and much more. That's myfloridahistory.org. Joining us now is Connie Lester, Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly. Connie, Virgil Hawkins is a well-known figure in Florida's civil rights history. The University of Florida College of Law website features his story.
Indeed, significant work has been published on his unsuccessful efforts to acquire a law degree from UF. Larry O. Rivers published an article in the winter 2008 issue of the Florida Historical Quarterly in which he explored the life of Virgil Darnell Hawkins, a complex and at times problematic figure in Florida's educational and legal history. A PhD candidate at Vanderbilt University at the time of publication, Rivers tied Hawkins' biography to the larger evolution of Black life in the period 1865 to the last decades of the 20th century. In framing the biography within the larger historiography, he illustrates the upward trajectory of a single family from slavery to landowning and education, as well as the fragility of each advancement. The realities of living in the Jim Crow South meant that every step forward and upward could also lead to a fall backward. Virgil Hawkins' father, Virgil William Hawkins, migrated from Georgia to Lake County in the 1890s in search of work. He took a job in a clay mine, saved his money, and in 1895 purchased 10 acres of land near Okahumpka for $200. Land ownership represented a step away from poverty and toward the creation of generational wealth. The ownership of even a small amount of productive land provided a sense of relief from economic exploitation that oppressed and limited the possibilities for most Blacks. 2 years after the land purchase, Hawkins married Josephine Arbell Brown, a Florida native and the daughter of an African Methodist Episcopal minister. The marriage enfolded him in what historians Larry E. Rivers and Cantor Brown described as, quote, the single most effective organizational force for Florida's Black residents, end quote. The marriage produced 6 sons and 2 daughters and saw incremental advances in the fortunes of the Hawkins family. Hawkins fed his family through his agricultural production and marketed the surplus. He opened a store across the road from the farm, and he picked citrus during the harvest season. Josephine took in washing and ironing for white families, an employment that brought in additional income, but also freed her from the oppressive work conditions of domestic labor in the homes of white women. Equally important, the familial relationship to Reverend Alfred Brown opened a world of education to Hawkins' family and encouraged the elder Hawkins to become a pastor like his father-in-law. Young Virgil Hawkins and his siblings attended a nearby Rosenwald School, which opened in 1917. The school was one of hundreds across the South that resulted from the collaboration between Booker T. Washington's Tuskegee Institute and Julius Rosenwald, the president of Sears Roebuck and a trustee at Tuskegee. Rosenwald provided funding that was matched by the community to construct black schools. It was a scheme to improve educational opportunities and bypass the abysmal state support for black education. The Okahumka Rosenwald School only included classes to the 10th grade. Virgil's father expected him to follow in his grandfather's footsteps and become a minister, but Virgil and his mother saw his future in the law. Virgil was aware of the injustices against black citizens perpetrated by the Lake County Sheriff, Henry F. Murray, and upheld through the court system. He remembered thinking that, quote, God needed someone in the courtroom just as he needs a man in the pulpit to save men's souls, end quote. With his mother's encouragement, Virgil approached his father with his ambitions. His parents supported his ambitions and sent him to Jacksonville to Edward Waters College to complete high school. Outside the campus, he discovered a vibrant black community that included some of the early attorneys, Joseph E. Lee, James Weldon Johnson, and Samuel Decatur McGill, men who would become legends in black jurisprudence. After completing his studies at Edward Waters, Virgil moved to Pennsylvania's Lincoln University in 1930 to study law. The Great Depression forced Virgil to return home after 1 year. Back in Lake County, he taught school and served as principal in a black elementary school in Groveland and married Ida Frazier, a schoolteacher.
Connie, this was a period of legal activism on the part of the NAACP, and yet still remained an era when acquiring a law degree seemed virtually impossible for black students.
In the 1940s, black attorneys challenged segregated education on the matter of unequal teacher salaries and access to graduate and professional degrees. A ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court in 1949 required states to provide blacks with access to white public law schools or create separate law schools for black students. Hawkins applied to the University of Florida, but was denied entry. In 1956, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Hawkins was, quote, entitled to prompt admission under the rules and regulations applicable to other qualified candidates, end quote. When the state and the Florida Supreme Court refused to act on his behalf, Hawkins withdrew his application in exchange for assurances that Florida would end segregation in state colleges and universities. The effort to attend law school had cost him enormously in lost income and in the duress from personal attacks and years of legal battles. Hawkins later attended law school in Boston, but the Florida bar denied him the opportunity to take the Florida bar exam, citing the lack of accreditation by the Boston school. In 1976, the Florida Supreme Court ordered that Hawkins be granted a license to practice law. In 1977, at age 69, he opened an office in Leesburg. His clients were generally indigent, and Hawkins faced considerable financial and workload obstacles. He soon faced disciplinary action, and unable to afford legal counsel, he soon resigned from the Florida bar. In 1988, he died. Numerous attorneys petitioned the court to reinstate his law license posthumously, which was done in October 1988. The following year, a legislative act named UF's Civil Law Clinic for Hawkins. 10 years later, the Florida Supreme Court issued a formal apology for denying Hawkins' application for admission to UF Law School. And finally, in 2001, UF awarded a Juris Doctorate to Hawkins, the first time the university had bestowed a posthumous degree. Rivers concludes, quote, as a child, Virgil Darnell Hawkins dreamed of entering the legal profession in order to fight Jim Crow. The foundation set by two previous postbellum generations that struggled for educational opportunities in Florida helped place that lofty career goal within his reach. Hawkins' experiences leading up to his desegregation lawsuit underscore how the agency that Black Floridians acquired through purchasing homesteads and establishing their own schools in the late 19th century helped launch the legal campaign that opened Florida's public schools to men and women of all races, end quote.
And Virgil Hawkins helped to pave the way for many African-American attorneys in Florida. Thanks, Connie.
You're welcome.
Connie Lester is Associate Professor of History at the University of Central Florida, Director of the Riches Digital Archiving Project, and Editor of the Florida Historical Quarterly.
Here's a few texts.
Don't worry, be happy.
Was the number one jam. Damn if I said you could slap me right here. Get it.
Let's get this party.
This is Florida Frontiers. Holly Baker has this look at a family of 10 children who all went to college under challenging circumstances in the mid-20th century.
80-year-old Ella Robinson McNary was born in Wildwood and grew up in Webster, Florida. Her parents, William Levy and Mary Lee Howard Robinson, were African-American sharecroppers who saved up enough money to buy their own 40-acre farm in 1939 for $300. There they built a farmhouse and raised a family. The Robinsons valued education and worked hard to send all 10 of their children to college.
We were very poor, but we didn't know it at the time. We grew up on a farm there in Webster, Florida. We lived way out in the country. And at first, before people realized as much as they got to know about our family, they would sometimes refer to us as the children from the woods, because it was a wooded area there in Webster, and it was way out in the country.
Ella Robinson McNary's father, William Levy Robinson, led by example. He encouraged his children to always do their best and to never give up.
Daddy, as far as I can see now, he was one of the most brilliant people on this planet, but he only finished eighth grade. His dad died when he was about 15 or 16, and he had to drop out of school. And then he was the oldest son, and he had to take care of the family. But he read everything that he could even get his hands on. And therefore, he taught us to do the same, because it seems to me that at nighttime, after Dad had maybe worked 14 or 15 hours, he'd come in the house, eat dinner, and that little dining room table became a schoolhouse. We had to sit there, listen to Daddy and some of his stories that he would tell us, and listen to him as he checked our schoolwork. And then during the summertime, when we were out of school, even though, you know, we worked some on the farm and did some of those things, we still had school. We never stopped going to school, because by that time, the oldest child would teach the youngest child. We had an old desk sitting outside of the house. And when it was your turn to be taught that day, the desk was yours. And the older one was the teacher. So that's the way we learned many things.
Mary Robinson, the matriarch of the family, also played a large part in getting her 10 children to go to college.
I don't know what actually precipitated Mom and Dad sending us off to college. Dad, I think, was very pleased with us graduating from high school. But Mom was really the pusher when it came to our going off to school. She was younger than Dad, and Mom would tell us that she wanted to be a teacher. That's what Mom would always tell us. She said, I wanted to be a teacher. But Mom only got to finish fourth grade. So Mom was one who kept a stack. Once she knew about Florida A&M University, because at that time we couldn't go to FSU or University of Florida. We had to go to FAMU because it was a Black college. And Mom kept a stack of registration applications on the coffee table in our living room. And if you came to our house and you were in 11th or 12th grade, Mama was going to give you a lecture about going to college. give you an application and give you a plate of food. And if you didn't want any food, she was going to give you a piece of sweet potato pie to take home. People gave Daddy most of the credit in our hometown because Daddy was the book smart person. And Mama had the wisdom. And I said, if you put wisdom and knowledge together, you've really got something. And they had it together. And that's how they really raised us.
Like all her siblings, Ella excelled at school. She would become the seventh Robinson child to leave the Little Webster farm and head to Florida A&M University. Ella Robinson McNary.
Then as we started going off to college, as they started sending us off to college, I know it was a struggle for them. I know it because I know they didn't have the money and so forth. I remember when I was in high school, someone would walk up to me and say, Ella, what are you going to do when you graduate from high school? And the only thing I knew to say was, oh, I'm going to college. Six people prior to me had gone, so then I knew that I was going. And I'm sure that's what my three younger sisters said, because others prior to them had gone. We became, in a sense, famous around in that area. Mom and Dad, they did mortgage. I tell you, they mortgaged that farm so many times, but they always paid it off. They'd pay off that mortgage. And see, the first five children were zap, 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 zap. They had one. George was there in 50. George graduated from high school in 50. W.L. 51. Raymond, 52. Lily, 53. So there were four right there. And then Ernestine was in 55. And at one time, I think it was five of us at Florida A&M at one time. And they were, as I might say, black and poor, poor, poor. And everything was segregated at that time. So it was a difficult time for them.
Despite the odds against them, all 10 Robinson children graduated from college and became successful in their chosen fields. Ella Robinson McNary became a registered dietitian and spent 3 decades working at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana. Her sister Dolores Robinson Brown became the first woman to graduate from Tuskegee Institute School of Engineering. Ella's brother Ira Robinson was the University of Florida's first black PhD graduate, earning a degree in industrial pharmacy. He was also the first black PhD senior research scientist at Pfizer. And at the age of 28, he became the nation's youngest pharmacy college dean at his alma mater, Florida A&M University. William Levy and Mary Lee Robinson's determination to educate their children placed them on a path to a better life outside of their small town. Today, the descendants of the Robinson family are spread out all over the United States. Their legacy is still remembered in Webster, Florida, and beyond. For Florida Frontiers, I'm Holly Baker, Public History Coordinator for the Florida Historical Society and Archivist at the Library of Florida History in Cocoa.
You've been listening to Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society. Please join us right here again next week. Until then, find us anytime online at myfloridahistory.org and on Facebook. Production assistance for Florida Frontiers comes from Connie Lester and Holly Baker. The program is edited by Giselle Concepcion. Have a great week. I'm Ben Brotmarkle. Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, is made possible in part by the Department of State Division of Historical Resources and the State of Florida. It's also made possible by the Jesse Ball DuPont Fund and by the historic Rossiter House Museum and Gardens in O'Galley, celebrating pioneer history, the natural environment, and women's history. Available for weddings and events at rossiterhousemuseum.org.